The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, the award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Coming up later on, we're going to be talking to Terry Tselane. Terry used to be a commissioner for the IEC. He is now the executive chair at a business that helps countries run elections. Going to be interesting. Mike Quinn has written a book called Failing to Win. He's the co-founder and former chief executive of a fintech business called Zuna, based in Zambia initially. We'll catch up with him and find out more about that. We'll do the luxury of conversation. We love luxury. We love conversation. Two things together. What a bonus. Chris Vaillant, the founder and chief executive of Vaillant's Tech with Toby, Bernard Mostert, co-founder of Techie Town, and a whole lot more coming up this evening on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
You would think that big companies with lots of outlets and massive balance sheets will be able to weather a crisis like what we have seen in South Africa in the last 2 months. The riots, of course, a recent memory, but the consequences of those riots still very, very present in the lives of business people, in large corporates and in small companies too. And it really doesn't take much to destroy a small business. And so what's been good about Sasria is that it's made up to a million rand available for a small claims as a result of those riots in KZN and Gauteng, because those tiny businesses certainly couldn't wait, if they want to restart, to wait for their money. But now Insurance Claims Africa is recommending that Sasria pay up to 30% of the insured amounts to big businesses affected by the riots, pay them up front and provide some interim relief. Sasria, of course, did fast-track payments to small businesses of up to R1 million. Ryan Woolley is the chief executive of Insurance Claims Africa. What is the process here, Ryan? I mean, what is actually going on in terms of these claims?
Well, I think what you've got to understand is that it's actually quite a... you've got tens of thousands of claims that have flooded into Sasria who essentially aren't really equipped for this sort of volume of claims. And you've got loss adjusters that are running off all their COVID-19 work, and now they've been forced to deal with all the Sasria work on top of it. And essentially, the bottleneck is there. There's just it was inevitable that it was going to be an administrative, bureaucratic process that had to be followed. And unfortunately, it's just too slow.
When we look at Sasria, and Sasria was developed in 1979, and the assumption with Sasria's creation was, if there's a riot, you send the cops along, they go and fire tear gas and ask people to step aside and all of that sort of stuff. Everybody calms down and perhaps they go home. Maybe they stick around and things get a bit tight and reinforcements are called. Nobody ever anticipated that, one, there would be such extraordinary widespread action, as we saw with the looting that happened in July, and that it would go unattended for up to, what was it, 5 or 6 days. I mean, this thing was compounding at a frightening rate by the hour. And security forces were sitting on the sidelines, you know, watching and hamstrung by political inaction.
Well, you know, Sasria has been around, like you mentioned, for some time. And I think it is a risk that was noticed. It was identified very early on. And it has been maintained. And it is actually a very well-run business. Yep. I think that it's provided money to the fiscus many times, you know, over the last 20-odd years. You know, and unfortunately, this time round, I think that Sasria are now going to be found to be a little bit short in terms of what they have to pay. I think the losses are estimated at about 20 to 25 billion in terms of what they are liable for. On top of that, there's your riot wrap insurers that go into London, which apparently also sits at $1 million or so. $1 billion or so. So, you know, it's a significant loss. And I think that there was foresight, which is why, you know, Sasria exists. But yes, to the extent, I think that's caught everybody a bit by surprise. I think that they're going to have to make sure that they reinsure properly if they can get it in the future and appropriately charge for the premium.
What are, and appropriately charged for premium, and we've all seen, if we've looked at our, if we bothered to look at our insurance statements, we've all seen a really, really small charge for riot damage, because, hey, what are the odds? Until it happens, of course. And then we have these businesses get hit, and the payments of R1 million to small businesses, I think, are laudable and are brilliant. Why should Sasria be stumping up 30% of insurable claims in the meantime, while there's still an underwriting process ongoing?
Well, I think essentially it's to their benefit. You know, these companies, they've admitted liability. There's no dispute over whether they should be paying these claims or not. It's now just about how much. And one of the things that we realized with the COVID-19 claims is that if you put money in the hands of these businesses, they will mitigate your long-term losses. Remember, Sasria is also on the hook for business interruption losses and the like. But at the moment, these guys don't have any stock. They can't afford to replace any stock. They can't afford to do any of their repairs. A lot of these businesses, the stock was everything. And you know, they lived out of these businesses. And now we're finding that they can't afford to get up and running, which means that their business interruption losses only get bigger. And what we would like to see is Sasria come forward with a payment. Our recommendation is 30% of the sum insured. And on that basis, you know that you're not overpaying. You can then give the funds, make it available to the insurers, and they can run with it. And also think about the job retention, because I think that that's what's going to be the next wave, is that there is going to be further unemployment if money isn't released into the system.
It's happening already, and we're seeing it on a daily basis. Thank you, Ryan, Chief Executive at Insurance Claims Africa. I think it's a reasonable enough request if there's somebody who understands the technicalities of insurance, particularly with regards to Sasria, as to why that should not happen. I'd love to hear it. Certainly, I think Ryan makes a compelling argument.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
It seems like Eskom's power stations really are in the wars. We had an explosion at Mudupi the other day. Now over the weekend, a fire at the Kendal power station in Gauteng. Eskom says that load shedding will probably be averted, but we saw both units 2 and 3 of the Kendal power station affected. Eskom saying that they will return to service early this week. Now, Bruce Moyo is the general manager for Cluster of Power Stations at Eskom. It's an interesting title in Emalahleni this evening. Bruce, just give us, tell us what you know about the fires over the weekend.
Hi, Bruce, yeah. No, yeah, on Saturday early morning, we got a fire on the generator transformer. And currently, we are having every expert to investigate what could have been the source of the fire. It's not that easy to come to a conclusion. We can, just by seeing, say that a fault might have developed on the blue fence, but we are not that currently sure where the fault could have come from.
Is there anything to suggest that foul play is present here?
Nah, that one I would not say there was foul play, because what generally happens with a general transformer, when you develop a fault, then we have got protection, which will then take off in terms of the 400 kV breaker on the yard, and then the 22 kV breaker on the...
Bruce, you've just started speaking electrician to me, and I'm afraid I've lost you. Okay, I've got a circuit board in my house. I can understand that, and there are lots of switches. Yeah. I'm assuming a power station looks a bit like that. If there's a dodgy plug in my house, or if somebody's got underfloor heating and the wires have melted, things trip off. This didn't trip, or did it?
You're saying that, the unit tripped, of course. So the breakers isolate the transformer from the yard and from the unit. So that is how we realized that we had a fault on the transformer, because generally it will trip. And then when they went to check what could have caused the trip, then they found that there was a fire.
How extensive is the fire? Was it left unattended for quite some time?
No. Immediately when there is a fire, obviously, we have got a protection system which starts spraying on where the fire is, because the transformer is protected to minimize the damage. But unfortunately, we don't know whether the generation of the fire was, whether it could have something which like the bushing, which could have exploded, which renders our protection system not that sufficient to extinguish it. But immediately, we called our fire teams who attended to the fire.
Thank you, Bruce Moyo.
We have got a lot of oil, which then exacerbates the because you know the transformer is full of oil, so it becomes.
No, I didn't actually, but I'm delighted that you've told me, Bruce Moyo. it's a deeply technical discussion, but thank you very much. I mean, there was a fire, there was oil, it was a problem. Firemen got there, firefighters, people who put out fires, got there, put out the fires, but there is damage. And again, your immediate assumption after an explosion in Medupi is, oh, fire at a Kendall power station. Let's rule out foul play. It seems as Eskom has ruled out foul play. I'm not too sure why we're so deeply suspicious, or at least my producers are so deeply suspicious of what goes on at Eskom. But I suppose history gives us plenty of cause to be concerned when unusual things happen, and hence we need to check it out. Bruce Moyo, who speaks on behalf of Eskom, less concerned.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Peter Brook with the Old Mutual Investment Group. He is a portfolio manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group. How did you make of markets today, Peter? A bit calmer than they have been in recent weeks.
That's right. A nice solid day for the market, up 0.6%. Well, if you look at the more diversified index, the shareholder weighted, the CAP 6 index, that was up 1%. So pretty solid gains, fairly widely spread, actually.
That was nice to see, and it was good to see lots of buying happening in SA Inc. companies. There was quite a lot of buying in our commodity shares, in the banking sector, and quite a few of the industrials went stronger too.
Yeah, so I think the standout for the day was Sasol, which was up 8.5%. And that's really following a flat 6 months. So higher oil price globally has triggered generally energy shares around the world are the best performing sector on the day. A little bit more of a value bias, particularly when we look in the US, and tech a little bit weaker. So in South Africa, Prosus and Naspers dragging on the index a little bit. You know, once again, news out of China in terms of regulations, this time attacking Alipay within the Alibaba ecosystem.
I mean, you were apprehensive about what was going on in China the last time we spoke, which was probably a month ago, and was just beginning to see the start of the huge sell-off that we've seen in China as investors really have panicked out of technology shares facing this greater level of intrusion and regulation by the Chinese government. At some point, though, things begin to offer better value. At some point, the risk-reward ratio returns to something more reasonable. Are we anywhere close to that?
It's really tricky sort of catching a falling knife because you've actually got multiple impacts. One is you've got the very genuine impact in terms of what price earnings multiple do you pay for earnings in China. It's the same sort of issue in Russia, whereby you tend to always trade cheaper because at the end of the day, the head of the government can tell you what to do. But also sort of related to that, in the Chinese example now, you've got a very, very strong stimulus not to make a big profit because that's against the common prosperity mandate. So actually, these companies are going to be investing much more aggressively. They're going to be paying their workers more. So you've got a decrease in PE and a decrease in earnings. So I think it's actually going to be a tough time for China. And then also, you know, if you just look at China's weight within emerging markets, it really argues much more for picking. You don't want to buy a broad basket, as in just overall emerging markets. It's where are the opportunities by country, as opposed to how do we avoid this China issue. So I'm sure there's lots of people who are buying before. We haven't actually added to our Naspers and Prosus positioning. So far, that's turned out okay. I'm sure there will be opportunities, but on a longer, you know, sort of over the next year, I think there's better places to make money.
I mean, that's a really interesting perspective. You haven't added, but you haven't been sort of running for the hills and throwing shares to the nearest buyer yet either. That's what you're implying.
No, so that's, I suppose it all depends, as always, your perspective is where you stand. So because we had already sold a lot of our holdings in Naspers in process, so we were quite heavily underweight, there was less catalyst to act. So we already were underweight. We sold a little bit in the very early days in terms of the regulation, and we're now sort of going, it's too early to buy.
Got you on that one. Famous brands Raubex and Remgro out with various forms of trading updates today. Any standout features?
Well, if you look at Raubex, which is up 3.6% today, look, I've got to admit to a bit of a bias here. We are overweight the company, and felt it was a good. There was good news. Basically, you know, as always, when you're comparing year on year, you've got a COVID base. So last year was a loss. So then this year's profits look very good. But interestingly, if you compare it to 2 years ago, pre-COVID, it's more than 100% up. So strong order book. The SANRAL road building mandates are out. So they've secured a lot of that business. You know, their bitumen, which is used to lay on the roads, that's already starting to fire up, which is good news because South Africa needs that capex. And then in terms of looking forward, we've still got the renewable energy windows to come. So that hasn't even been awarded out yet. So I think that generally these sort of fixed capital formation type companies will have a good order book coming through. I was just looking at it, or capex to GDP in South Africa is at 15%. That's a really low level. So it's easy for things to improve from here.
And that's encouraging. And we've got some pretty good companies who can capitalize on that. And Raubex is seen as amongst them. Remgro as a diversified bet on the South African economy. It's always an interesting company to look at. Lots of what you can get inside Remgro, you can get elsewhere. You don't necessarily need to buy an investment holding company. These things frustratingly charge at huge discounts to the underlying value often. But in there, you can get a little bit of a petrol station, and you can get a couple of bits and pieces that you can't get on the JSE or through any other mechanism on the markets, local markets.
Yeah, so I suppose Remgro is quite interesting at the moment. So just in terms of the trading statement today, the share is up 1.6%. Headline earnings per share for the 12 months expected to be up between 61 and 71%. Once again, base effects. I suppose interesting within that is strong recovery from Distell. With RCL Foods, what we used to call Rainbow Chickens, while Mediclinic lagging. But I think the relevant part is they are starting to invest a bit more aggressively. So they are putting some of that cash pile to work. And then potentially you've got this Heineken bid for Distell, chasing the Savannah Cider brand. Because if that happens, then there'll be a big, you know, probably 10 billion rand release of capital coming out of there. The discount has narrowed a bit. It's trading at a 34% discount. And, you know, as you start to sort of tidy up the portfolio and invest a bit more, I think that makes it a bit more interesting as a broad diversified play.
It is interesting. I mean, Ria, Remgro, and where the money goes, of course, that it gets out of its Distell investment is what is going to be most interesting, I suppose, because, you know, there are plenty of places that require capital. Are there many places that, you know, will use the capital wisely, I wonder?
Yeah. Or they can return it to shareholders.
They could. But that's so dull.
Okay, show me the money.
Is that what you would want at this stage, Peter? The money in your hands to do with as you please, rather than the money left in management hands to apply as they see fit?
In terms of investment holding companies, with big discounts, generally I prefer the money back, because let's say you're buying it for a rand, there's a rand worth of value, but you're only paying 75 cents. If they pay you a rand dividend, you've made a big gain. Whereas, let's say at the moment, you know, some of the team were talking to Sabania. They've got huge profits flowing. We would like to see some of that money spent on renewable energy projects to de-risk their energy supply. So it sort of varies on the project. Generally, holding companies at discounts, you want the money back. When there's good opportunities to invest, then you want the company to spend as much money as possible, because if you're getting a high return on invested capital, then it's better that they have it and grow the economy, but also grow the future value of the business. Because remember, when we buy these shares, we get in the future cash flows. So if they're investing wisely, you want management to be empowered to spend that money.
Peter Brook, always lots of wisdom there. Always, thank you. Portfolio Manager at the Old Mutual Investment Group.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning, secure, single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
Bernard Motzert is standing by. He's the co-founder of Techie Town. A fascinating discussion to follow on the rights and wrongs of a deal done about 5 years ago. On the next Money Show, we go through African Rainbow Capital's results. Big investors in the South African economy. How well are those bets paying off? FNB's Chantal Marx is head teacher for this week in our big investment focus. And she'll explain the trendy but critical environmental, social and governance strategy when it comes to investing, ESG, they call it. And Andy Rice, Heroes and Zeros, all coming up on The Next Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Matching foresight with sustainable possibilities, unlock your business's potential. APSA Insights, brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking on 702 and Cape Talk. And you don't just need data to keep track of records and keep track of trends that are shaping the economy. You need the expertise to turn that data into valuable insights and sustainable growth opportunities. And in the APSA Insights podcast series this month, I'm focusing on enterprise supplier and development. And in this episode, I chat to Jacques DeForce, the Chief Executive Officer at Mezzanine, asking him how the Internet of Things, your kettle talking to your toaster, talking to your fridge and all sorts of other, and now your car probably as well, is connecting rural farmers to the world and aiding the survival of entire communities in remote areas through digital solutions. It's nothing short of mind-blowing.
Yeah, I think that the part that we're excited about is the fact that we can make these benefits available to literally millions of farmers. At the moment, we support about between 2.5 and 3 million of these farmers with a number of these digital services. We use technology and we've used the reach of mobile to, in effect, enable the insurers to serve what was an underserved segment of the market, which for them is a big new opportunity. So moving from being confined to servicing commercial farmers in, let's say, South Africa and maybe a handful in the rest of Africa, to 77 million potential new customers. Now, this is attractive to any multinational looking at expanding into new regions, into new segments.
Jacques DeForce, the Chief Executive Officer at Mezzanine. You can catch my full chat with Jacques DeForce on your favorite podcast app or on our websites, Cape Talk. .co.za or 702.co.za. Just look out for the APSA Insights feature.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show. Now, the creation of Techie Town is one of my favorite stories, and I'm going to give you the quickest possible summary. A guy whose mum owned a clothing boutique in Mossel Bay at the time of the gas boom and was selling branded clothing to wannabe fashionable workers. And a young guy, whose son mortgaged his house and bought a consignment of Caterpillar boots at a massive discount and then hustled them through farmers' co-ops and became so successful that he eventually set up a network of shops which grew exponentially through the global financial crisis because shopping centre owners were only too grateful to have tenants. Then a guy who befriended him at the horse races suggested they went on a trip to Eastern Europe to see how they were rolling out PEP in Eastern Europe. And wouldn't it be good to get the Techie Town concept of brand new but slightly out of season shoes onto people's feet in Eastern Europe. And the Techie Town founder, of course, went, that sounds promising. Techie Town was exchanged for Steinhoff shares, and then the accounting scandal at the company broke. The share price of Steinhoff collapsed in a heap, which meant that the guys who had sold Techie Town to Steinhoff found that the shares they held were almost worthless. And now Bernard Mostert wants Steinhoff to give the company he founded back and is applying for its liquidation. Bernard Mostert on the line to us from George this evening, the co-founder of Techie Town. He's with us now. The liquidation, has application been heard? What is the status of this liquidation application, Bernard?
Bruce, good evening. Maybe if I may, just one correction. Brompton Aston was the founder of...
Oh, beg your pardon, Bernard. I'm getting... Yeah. You guys, I haven't seen you for so long. And Bram and you, I mean, you're like peas in a pod. You're like twins. Forgive me. Okay, Bernard Mostert is one of the co-founders. Bram is the guy whose life story I was telling, and I'm getting old. There we go, Bernard. Sorry, I've done the correction for you.
No, Bruce, as time goes by, these facts seem to get muddied, you know, so it's good to chat to you again. You know, our journey continues. We brought a liquidation application against Steinhoff for very simple reasons. And we've had some internal delays in terms of hearing that matter. And it has been ruled that South Africa does have jurisdiction in that case. And then it has been ruled that the application to postpone the case has been dismissed. So I guess tomorrow the show gets on the road, but there will undoubtedly be further attempts to delay it, because I think it's very much in line with what we've seen from Steinhoff over the last 4 odd years.
Okay, so Steinhoff at the moment is doing a deal, or has got the support to do a deal with creditors. People like Christo Visa, who was on the show last week, who said, we want to get money out. We could sue. We could take this to the bitter end. We could apply globally for the liquidation, but we don't think we'll do as well out of it as we get a settlement. They seem to be on the path to a settlement. You, however, are applying for the liquidation of Steinhoff because you say Techie Town was bought from you fraudulently. Explain the basis of that claim.
Sure. I mean, I'm not going to repeat the whole story, but the long and the short of it is that we exchanged our controlling share in shares in Steinhoff that we couldn't trade. And at the time, we, in our due diligence, relied on the information that was available to us. And you know, pretty much like everybody else say today, we didn't see this 106 billion rand hole in the accounts of Steinhoff, which Deloitte also didn't see. You know, so if I can go straight to the settlement process, and I think it's an important aspect, the only people that are voting in favor of the settlement process now are people who stand to gain mightily from it, profiteer from it, in other words, like the financial creditors, people who wish to see who don't wish to see the inside of a courtroom for whatever reason, and then people who previously, Steinhoff said, have no claim, who have been bought to support the, who have been effectively bought to support the claim. So it's a bit of a falsity to say that all creditors vote in favour of the plan, because if I ask you, do you think it's constitutionally fair that somebody who won't be compromised at all, like the financial creditors, can vote that we, for instance, would be compromised by 96%. And I would say that's not constitutional.
The question of who, whether or not you were defrauded. Now, and this is why I was hoping to speak to Bram, actually, on this particular one, because I'm curious as to whether he and Marcus are still the big chummies that they were when I last spoke to him very soon after this incident, 2017 or thereabouts, 2018. And he said, no, we're fast friends. We're absolute chums. Marcus is my friend, regardless of what's happened. It was Marcus Juister and Bram van Haestien who did the deal, the chommies. They were buddies. They met at the horse racing track. They went on this Eastern European trip together. And Marcus said to Bram, I'll give you some Steinhoff shares. Bram said, sure, that's great, whatever the script says on that particular one. They did the deal. The fraud was revealed later. I wonder whether or not Marcus Juister and Bram van Haestien are still chums.
Okay, yeah. Bruce, that's easy to answer. I don't think of late Brahm and markets have seen one another, but I don't think Brahm's position towards markets have really changed. He has said that he has forgiven him. I've forgiven him. Marcus has apologized to both of us for what he's caused us. And, you know, I'm just going to, maybe if I may, correct you in a few respects. So our transaction was not done next to a race course. As a matter of fact, it was done in a boardroom in Stellenbosch.
No, absolutely. I accept that completely, but the background to this deal was done between friends, between Brahm and Marcus, who were fast friends, and they agreed that this deal would be done. Then the legalities, all of the other stuff happens in boardrooms, it happens in lawyers' meeting rooms, all of that sort of stuff. The fraud, if a fraud happened, did it not happen between friends? Did it really happen between companies?
Yeah, well, Bruce, if I can, I wasn't finishing my earlier point, so I'll finish it just now. But sure. I think you would find it interesting to know that Brahm wasn't fast friends with Marcus when he was asked to do the deal. As a matter of fact, he met Marcus for the first time 4 weeks prior. So I don't know, unless it is corporate speed dating par excellence, that you can't become fast friends with somebody in the space of 4 weeks. And during those 4 weeks, our due diligence kicked off. And our deal ultimately culminated in an approval by the board of Steinhoff that was at a celebrated number of accounting experts on its board. And finally, you know, we had two interviews with Dr. Visa as the chairman of Steinhoff at the time before our deal was approved. So, frankly, the notion that this was a deal done between friends, etc., is just unfortunately nonsense.
But they remain friends. I mean, the fact is they had a connection. People get married in less time, and some of those marriages work and some of them don't work, Bernard. But, I mean, here's a scenario where this deal is done. You guys saw dollar signs. You saw Steinhoff dollar signs. You're now claiming that because you were defrauded by the company. The company says, hold on a second, we didn't know what was going on. There's a 900-page PwC report that I don't know if you've seen, I have not seen it, that suggests that there was a massive fraud that was spearheaded by Marcus Huerster. Lots of paths lead to Marcus Huerster. If you are successful in liquidating the business of Steinhoff for a transaction that you went into seeing dollar signs and with your eyes wide open, is that fair to all concerned, or is this purely a self-serving gesture by people who got caught on the wrong side of a fraud?
No, well, listen, the first point is obviously if we were seeing dollar signs, we would have taken cash, so which we didn't take, as a matter of fact. So we can agree that we weren't paid for our business at all. And then the next part is that, you know, I appreciate the narrative about friends, et cetera, and it's, there's very much a Dol Pottinger element to that because people don't want us to succeed. But frankly, I think our efforts to bring the PwC report into the open, to have the proceeds of the fraud addressed appropriately, suggest that we have nothing to hide, which we don't. But it do suggest that those who are wanting to participate in the proceeds of the fraud, who doesn't want to publish the PwC report, who's happy to bring out their vote of support, it doesn't, you know, and frankly, a large number of those people were very, very close to Marcus and made a lot of money off him. So I disagree with you, but that's the beauty of life. We can disagree.
The courts will decide, Bernard. I mean, and you're going to court. When do you expect a ruling as to whether or not you get your way to get Steinhoff liquidated?
Well, we're in the middle of that court case, so we've already had, I think, 4 days in court. We've had two rulings that that set the ground rules that the proceedings can be in South Africa and that the request for postponement by Steinhoff has been dismissed. So we head off to court again tomorrow.
Well, yeah, look, it's going to be fascinating. Bernard Mostert, the co-founder at Techie Town. Apologies for the identity crisis at the beginning. But the story is there. I mean, the story is in the public domain. The story has been told many, many ways and in many, many forums. And it kind of, things do become muddied. But that's why you have the courts. That's why you have this process. And these guys are fighting tooth and nail to get Techie Town back. Very happy to take the shares in Steinhoff at the time. And, you know, again, the exact history of the friendship, again, is muddied. studied in history, and only the proponents of these deals really know what happened, and the courts will decide as to who is right and who is wrong and who should benefit at the end of the day. Messy.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
And on that idea of luxury, we would be chatting to Mr. Luxury himself, and that is Chris Vaillant, the chief executive at Vaillant's, after Eyewitness News at 7. Toby Shapshak is Mr. Tech. Tech with Toby this evening. Ray-Ban stories. Facebook on your face. Oh, it sounds like hell. Do you buy this for somebody who was mean to you in the playground when you were a kid, Toby?
Yes, probably I would. I mean, you know, it's Facebook are the latest big tech firm to have a go at these sophisticated smart glasses, I suppose they could be called. You're going to have to excuse me when I sneeze.
Bless you, Toby. It's quite all right.
Thank you.
You could have timed your sneeze better, but you did that very elegantly, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. And so first it was Google with their very infamous and poorly received Google Glass. Snap have come out with their spectacles, and now of course it's Facebook's turn. They partnered with the makers of the iconic sunglasses, Ray-Ban. I mean, you know, the I don't know the names of them. The Wayfarers, I think, are the ones Tom Cruise wore in I forget the name of the movie as well.
Top Gun.
There we go. Top Gun. Yes, these are not going to make you look like Tom Cruise in Top Gun. Even Tom Cruise with much work done in the remake of Top Gun 20 years later, because they are, well, they're just a little bit geeky. And I think what Facebook's trying to do is edge people towards this new vision they have of the internet, which they've taken the phrase the metaverse. It was actually coined by the science fiction writer Neal Stephenson in a book called Snow Crash. But it's that kind of augmented reality and virtual reality that Facebook think is going to be a big thing. So Zuckerberg himself he said it, Bruce, don't shoot the messenger. He said glasses are going to be an important part of building the next computing platform. So I suppose he wants people to get used to seeing, you know, overlays over reality, which is what augmented reality is. So you get more comfortable being inside. Augmented reality, you get more comfortable being inside VR, which is virtual reality. I mean, who knows? Much more pressing problem, of course, is Facebook's continuing dalliance with privacy, which has just come out this month, that Facebook is actually listening to WhatsApp messages or videos or looking at them if someone else on the service tags them or reports that message or video or picture as being inappropriate. So first Facebook or WhatsApp's algorithms check it, and then it's referred to a human who looks at it.
You know what's so interesting here? I mean, WhatsApp now testing a voice note transcription feature, which I am so fully in favor of, because I think the voice note is this decade's crime against humanity. I really do, because nobody blooming can keep things concise. But having a transcription of that voice note is brilliant, because therefore you get it transcribed. But now they've got a text version of it.
Yes. Me too. I used to subscribe to a service years ago that converted voicemail to text. It was really fantastic. And when they stopped doing that, I just turned off my voicemail. I love the way people always leave a voicemail saying, don't leave a voicemail. And they get really angry when people do. You just turn off your voicemail and no one can do it. But
can I do that? I'm going to send you a WhatsApp and you can tell me how to do it, okay? Because I need to switch off my voicemail. I haven't listened to it for years.
I shall.
Toby Shapshak, thank you. Tech with Toby on a Monday night.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
The The Money Show brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We're going to talk luxury in the moment with the king of luxury, really. And that is none other than Chris Vaillant, the founder of Vaillant. He's the chief executive of Vaillant, a really, really lovely furniture store, national furniture store. We'll find out how they're doing. Mike Quinn is the author of Failing to Win. It's a title, very clever title. It could be taken either way. And then Terry Tselane is the executive chair at the Institute of Election Management Services in Africa. And we're going to talk to him about elections, the IEC, his time in tourism, growing up in Rustenburg. Lots to chat to Terry Tselane about. That's all coming up this evening on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
The luxury of conversation brought to you by the Lexus LS500. Experience amazing on 702 and Cape Talk. So what is luxury? Well, I suppose different people will define it as different things. I'm hoping to be able to drive maybe even as soon as tomorrow the LS500. So the next time I have one of these chats, I'll be better to be able to define what it means from a car perspective. But the images I've seen, the interiors scream luxury. You know what else screams luxury? Vaillant's scream. Actually, it doesn't scream luxury at all. It says luxury without being in such bad taste to even mention it. It just oozes luxury. Chris Vaillant, I'm digging a hole for myself. Founder and chief executive of Vaillant. What's luxury to you, Chris?
Evening, Bruce. Good to chat to you. What's luxury to me? I mean, I think you describe our luxury as humble luxury. I think it's authentic, and it's really just appreciation of beautiful items, beautiful, you know, furniture and homeware for our homes, and just the attention to detail and the quality, and just like the integrity of the materials that we use.
Materials. I think that's maybe the key point. And it's proper leather and it's real wood. I don't know if you have anything with laminate in it anywhere, but I mean, one gets the sense that that real natural elements have been brought into absolutely everything that you've produced. And I think that's been the ethic right from the very start, hasn't it?
True. I think our philosophy has been kind of the same from day one. But we kind of refining and we kind of agile and we kind of the kind of core principles of the brand is the same, but kind of we've got to be relevant all the time and kind of just innovate and refine and be better.
When did the Vaillant journey start? It feels like you've been around forever, but it must be 20 years, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think it's 22 years now in South Africa. And the story goes back way longer and from Namibia. But yeah, the operation in South Africa is just 22 years now.
And so the origins are Namibian?
So my dad immigrated from Germany and he started a small furniture store in Windhoek. And I'm a chartered accountant and I kind of just happened to help out in the family business. And one thing led to another, and I started manufacturing, and then eventually moved to South Africa to kind of start manufacturing and the retail stores.
So what's better, having an uncle in the furniture business or a father? I guess a father in the furniture business is far more, you end up with a far more authentic sort of look and feel. When you started manufacturing, I mean, is any of what you started out doing still in place? I mean, do you still use the same factory? Do you still have the original store? Tell me about that.
So I started manufacturing in 96, so still in the same premises. We obviously just grown quite a bit. And our original store was in Durbanville, 99, Cape Town, that we opened. And it was kind of a unique shopping experience, which was different to kind of what was in the market at that time. So local manufacturing has always been a passion of mine, and we're kind of growing it every year. And kind of especially if you look at the supply chain challenges, and the rand, et cetera, local, besides employment and the good kind of economic factors, it's becoming more and more important.
How do you keep a grip on quality? Because, you know, it's not, I don't think you manufacture each and every single item. I think there are some imports and there you do bring things in from elsewhere. How do you ensure quality? What you know, do you drop it out of a third floor window to make sure that that it doesn't break? How do you manage that?
It's obviously been in the business for many years now, so we've got lots of experience. And we have a long relationships with our supplier base. So I think it's like choosing your partner. You know, you got to choose, make sure you choose the right partner that kind of is going to be around for many years. Choosing the partner, the supplier, it's got to have the core values, kind of, you know, the quality, the way they manufacture, the staff behind it. So there's so much that goes into the supply chain that's taking more than 20 years to kind of establish and really have a good understanding and continuously kind of monitoring it and improving it. And, you know, we do a lot of in-house design locally, but we manufacture it worldwide. But it's just being on top of it on an ongoing basis.
What keeps you sharp? What keeps you relevant? Because, I mean, the industry is so competitive, so competitive. You've got independent manufacturers, you've got big chains, you've got importers. I mean, there's a huge amount of competition. How do you stay sharp and relevant to your market?
We small team. We extremely passionate what we're doing. And we aware of what's going on, you know, not just locally, but worldwide. So we're constantly on a drive for kind of improvement. And that's just kind of how we live. That's kind of, we don't have balance in life, unfortunately, but at least you're dealing with a beautiful product.
You sell lifestyle, right? So my assumption is Chris Verlaat spends half of his time schluffing on couches, big leather couches, feet up on lovely ottomans, drinks being brought to him and fancy side tables by people carrying lovely trays of crystal. No, it's not that, is it?
No, well, it's not. Yes, we're in a beautiful environment. I have no waiter. Kind of got to get my own drink. But it's just constant. While kind of we're traveling and while we're being out and about, it's just the constant awareness of what's around you and kind of seeing what other businesses are doing and how can we improve from a technology, where's going from a customer experience. So it's just that excitement of, that's retail. I mean, retail is such an exciting industry. A lot of them, it was always interesting listening to the Shark Tank. Whenever someone came up with a retail idea, they all said, no, we don't want to put money into it. But but it is quite exciting, the retail industry, because it is the consumer demands that kind of the lifestyles are changing constantly. And if you're not on top of it, kind of you're going to go backwards very quickly.
You do like luxury, though. I mean, you like South African wine. You like lovely South African restaurants. You like the top places, not only South African restaurants. You do like to travel the world and sample the wares of fabulous places around the globe. You're not averse to having a good time.
I love to having a good time. It's all part of it. And, Kim and myself, we do the traveling together. And that also makes a big difference doing it with your partner, because it can get quite lonely when kind of traveling abroad and exploring, etc. So we do it together and we have a fabulous time doing it.
What is your favorite restaurant?
Chef's Warehouse, the Beau Constantia in at Maison at in a farm in Franschhoek.
Okay. So South African restaurants opposed to, I saw a bio of you mentioning one in Sydney and another one here and another one there. I think our South African restaurants, I mean, especially the top restaurants, will box against any Michelin-starred restaurant anywhere in the world, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, we've traveled the world now. There are great restaurants, but I think there's such talent here and the quality of, or what's the creativity, talent. So, so it's definitely a favorite of mine here locally. This exciting stuff happening continuously.
And great wine being made.
Yeah, totally.
You got to name a favorite, I'm sorry. We're talking luxury. Go mad. There's no budget.
There's so many unique wines, but obviously our own wine Maison, you got Almanac, you got what did I have the other day? Can't find another word.
No, that's fine. You'll get it in a moment. Tell me about Maison. Yeah. The process of Maison. Do you buy in the grapes? Do you stomp them yourself? How does that process work?
So Maison is a 10-hectare wine estate in France, and we only make wine what we produce. So it's the challenge is that you got to produce quality wine every year. There is no second chance that you can buy in grapes from somewhere else and kind of disguise it or kind of make do with the bad grapes that you're growing. So it's only what we grow. It's very simplistic in the way we make our wines, not too complicated. I think that's, again, part of the essence of the Valence brand is kind of the simplicity. And we all know that simplicity can be very complex. It's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. Chris, now listen, there's lots to talk about, and I don't know about you, but once we pass COVID, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to ask those nice people at Lexus, maybe the L500, the LS500, send a driver to fetch you and to bring you, and then we'll have a longer, more detailed, proper conversation. You open for that at some point in the future? After sanitizer and all of that sort of stuff. Oh, my goodness me. Chris Valence, lovely chat. Thank you very much. The epitome of luxury, Chris Valence, the simplicity, the elegance, and really getting to the bare essence of what defines luxury for Chris Valence, the chief executive, the founder at Valence, Chris Valence, this evening. The Lexus LS500 has a whisper quiet engine and noise-cancelling doors, which afford you the luxury of great conversations uninterrupted. In the LS500H, the noise takes a back seat to the conversations that matter to you. The new Lexus LS500 range is here, transcending luxury and aspiration. Lexus, experience amazing.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. Terry Tselane is going to join us in a couple of minutes' time. Terry is a former commissioner of the IEC, and he is in the business of elections nowadays, making sure that other people have successful elections across the globe. So looking forward to catching up with Terry Tselane. On now to Mike Quinn. Mike Quinn is the author of a book called Failing to Win. He's the co-founder and former group chief executive at a business called Zuna. What, Mike Quinn, is Zuna?
Hi, Bruce. Thank you very much for having me on the show. Zuna is actually pronounced Zona. It started out of Zambia back in 2009. And we were one of the very first fintech businesses on the continent that grew to provide mobile money transfer services for unbanked and underserved consumers that needed to move money around for paying school fees or hospital bills or small businesses paying their suppliers. At the time, people had cell phones, but it was entirely a cash economy, so there was no mobile money. The majority of the population was unbanked. And we had a small technology center as well in Cape Town. So we always had this split setup with an operational arm and company in Zambia and then a fintech hub in Cape Town, and grew the business over the 10 years I was there to serve about 2 million active customers and process $2.5 billion of money transfers.
I mean, it's really ahead of its time, because so much of what you're talking about there is now commonplace. And it's a hell of a thing being a pioneer in a world that doesn't know what it wants or needs. And you really are cutting a new path.
Yeah, it was hard. Maybe just one of the hardest things we had to go through was how to raise investment to actually scale up this business, because the business was originally founded by two Zambian-born South African brothers. I'm Canadian, and I found myself working in Zambia and just serendipitously meeting these two guys. And they were entrepreneurs and had this idea. And then we recruited a fourth partner who became our CFO. And over the 10 years, we managed to raise $35 million US of venture capital, primarily from US global impact investors. But at the time, for the first 3 or 4 years, just finding money and was very difficult. We were living month to month, making decisions of, do we, you know, pay our staff, or do we pay our agents that were processing the money transfers commission, or pay our operating expenses to run our office. So it was very, very difficult. And just building, being at the forefront, I guess, of what is now an emerging ecosystem, hiring like technology developers in South Africa, where we built our technology hub. It always felt like we were on the leading edge, which was exciting. But looking back, it was also quite a tax on the company. And like you said, you know, being a pioneer is quite hard.
Absolutely. You've cut a path, I think, that many others have followed and sought to emulate as well. You talk about, you know, we raised $35 million as if it's, well, we went to the shops and we bought a litre of milk and it was delicious and cold and fresh. The first money, I mean, you can become quite obsessed about Africa. And I don't know whether when you went from Canada to Africa, whether you were at that point a man on a mission in 2009 looking for an opportunity, or whether you sort of tripped over the opportunity and went, oh, that's nice. Mum, Dad, can you sell your house so I can have $100,000, please?
So I had spent 2.5 years as a volunteer in the rural agriculture space, first in Ghana and West Africa, and then Zambia. And I then had the very fortunate opportunity of going to the UK and doing a master's and an MBA. And I met, when I was doing my MBA, a number of investors that were interested in Africa and kept telling me about this problem of the lack of deal flow. Which meant that they had money and they were looking to invest, but they had no idea where to put it. And that idea of, like, how do we find entrepreneurs who are purpose-driven and can build scalable businesses that can both help a lot of people and achieve the impact, but also make money at the end of the day. That was almost a foreign concept. And having spent a couple of years working in Africa, I put my hand up, and that was the mission I was on, where I said I can be a facilitator, and I built this network of investors. But I, you know, hopped on the plane and started searching for entrepreneurs that were building these businesses, and I really stumbled across these two brothers, Brad and Brett McGrath. They previously had a business in the airtime industry in Malawi, selling scratch cards and integrating a technology into one of the telcos in Malawi. And they had started the business originally in Zambia to facilitate payments from cotton companies to farmers. And this was previously all done in cash, but now we're in a situation back in, like, you know, 2009, 2010, where people are starting to get cell phones and getting connected to the internet. And meanwhile, there was a model that had kicked off in Kenya called M-Pesa that was really picking up steam, doing mobile money transfers. And so we put all these things together and said, well, you know, maybe we can take M-Pesa and the success in Kenya and bring it to Southern Africa, and created this vision of a cashless Africa. And I was able to use the connections and just go on a mission pitching for capital, including to my parents, as you mentioned, who mortgaged their house and lent me $100,000 to become a partner in the business. You know, gradually, bit by bit, we scaled up, and it never really took off. It was just a lot of hard grunt work. But eventually, you know, years and years of compounding growth achieved a number of successes.
But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, you talk in the book about just the horrors of doing what you're doing. The great satisfaction, but the horrors. I mean, let's face it. I mean, there must have been times where you thought to yourself, really? Is this what I signed up for? Is this my life? Can I not go and buy a suit and get a job in an air-conditioned office in Toronto or something like that? There must have been moments where you've gone, hold on a second, this far and no further.
Yes. Yeah, so some people ask me, are entrepreneurs born or bred? And probably a little bit of both, because I definitely had an empty toolbox when I started my entrepreneurial journey. And I know a lot more now about building companies than I did then. But I do think you need to have the innate ability to take a lot of risk and to fail repeatedly and learn from that failure. And so the book is called Failing to Win, because when I left Zona and looked back in hindsight, I realized that all of the success we achieved was preceded by a long string of failures. So that, you know, and those are often not talked about or written about or discussed, but you fail and fail and fail and fail until you figure it out. And then you get on your feet and keep doing it over and over again. And that's really the path of being an entrepreneur. And I was thinking about what to do next, because I, you know, spent 10 years building this company and didn't achieve like the big exit that is written about in, you know, Forbes magazine. And we had a lot of challenges at the end that nearly killed the company, but shrunk it down to a level that it was no longer on the path to achieve its original vision. And so I very much failed to win at Zona, but it was that process of failing that has set me up to then start another company. So I've got a new business now called Boost, which is also operational in South Africa, along with Ghana, Nigeria, and starting in Egypt now. And it's very much a version 2.0 of helping informal small entrepreneurs become part of the digital economy and grow their businesses to create sustainable jobs and income. And if I didn't fail at Zona repeatedly, and especially at the end, I never would have got to that next step of having the idea and the skills and experiences to set up a new company. And your reference of working, putting on a suit and tie and working for a corporate, for me, that's like the scariest thing in the world. That I feel much more comfortable being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. The ultimate failure would be, I suppose, doing precisely that. We are allergic to failure. I know South Africans are particularly allergic to failure. We don't like failure. We're very European, but I think the European culture, business culture, is also very anti-failure. But you seem to learn the lesson, and I think it's misquoting Churchill. It's a longer quote than this, but in there he says, failure is not fatal. And it's this ability to stumble forwards. I mean, you not even fail forwards, but stumble forwards, and to keep on going, which is, I suppose, the biggest victory of all, is no matter when you get out, but it is simply not to capitulate to the daily difficulties.
Yeah, I very much believe that failure can be a superpower if it's harnessed and really embraced. The key thing I've learned is you need to really separate being a failure from failing. Those are very different things, but you know, being a failure leads to self-loathing and often depression. It can put you down a very dark path. And we're humans, right? We experience this, and I didn't fail at Zona and feel great about it. Like it sucks to fail, and I definitely went through those moments of feeling like a failure. But gradually, through like support and talking to other entrepreneurs and founders, and realizing like, everybody goes through these experiences. Even the most successful entrepreneurs and founders and the people you will read about, they're on like their second, third, fourth business. The first few collapsed. They had to get up and do it over and over again. And that was, you know, very motivating for me, and just realizing like, okay, I didn't achieve everything I wanted to. And we didn't get to the, you know, the penultimate, you know, concept of, I guess, of winning, of becoming like a unicorn business that achieved like a $1 billion exit at some point, that is almost like the Silicon Valley folklore of success. You know, that was, if I can embrace that and harness that and really reflect on all those lessons learned and how would I do it all over again, and what are the things I would do differently, suddenly failure is something that becomes an input as part of a process towards new success and to winning in the future.
The final testing question, I suppose, is whether or not you paid your parents back their $100,000.
I did. I was lucky enough in the good years of my time at Zona to squirrel away some salary every month and pay them back bit by bit. And also the fortunate support of having my wife who is working and also with me every step of the way. So I paid them back, and then I took another loan to start my new business. So I owe them some more money now. But that's also the thing about, I think, being an entrepreneur is you having support of friends and family is like incredibly important. It's a very lonely journey at times. And you know, not everybody has a lot of money that they can tap into, but I've been very fortunate in that respect of having, you know, very supportive family.
Mike Quinn, thank you for telling your story this evening. The author of a brand new book called Failing to Win. Now, it's a nice title, because you're either never winning or you're failing repeatedly to finally win. I'm going to take it as that one, because and it talks about the upside of failure. It talks about the fact that failure is okay, provided you learn from your failures, provided that you build on your failures, provided you don't capitulate, provided you don't feel the failure. You fail and you learn and you grow and you develop. And that's what he did at Zona, and now doing at Boost. Mike Quinn, the author of a brand new book, Failing to Win.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
Former IEC Commissioner Terry Tselane, the executive chair now of the Institute of Election Management Services in Africa, IEMSA. We can't have a long name without an acronym. It's an organization that provides election management services mostly in Africa. Are you completely out of the IEC now, Terry? No direct connection there whatsoever.
Hi, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. Indeed, I am out of the Electoral Commission and its processes, and happy to be managing my little outfit called IEMSA, or Institute of Election Management Services in Africa, as you correctly pointed.
What does that little outfit do? I mean, you go from country to country and say, OK, listen, this is what you need to run successful elections.
Well, we deliver the elections for institutions that require us to do so, both in South Africa and internationally. But also, we give support to election management bodies, and then give also whatever support to the political parties that require our assistance with. For instance, empowered some of the political parties through training. We help the Inkatha Freedom Party training its party agents. We manage the elections of the economic freedom fighters. We recently manage the primaries of Action SA. So it depends really on the brief that we get from different political parties or any stakeholders or any of our clients. And as soon as we get that brief, we are able to deliver the services, as long as those services are within the electoral space.
When you look at the situation in South Africa 2021, is democracy as healthy and as secure as you would have hoped it would be by now, considering you were at the IEC quite some time ago?
I think the level of contestation has increased. There are new players that are coming in, and as a result of that, it is putting a lot of pressure on constitutional institutions. And we have seen over the years that the work that the Electoral Commission does is being scrutinized, and all the details are being looked into, and therefore the Commission has got an added responsibility of having to make sure that it delivers its responsibilities or mandate with integrity, knowing that there are difficulties that political parties may identify in the process of its delivery of those elections.
Would you support the IEC's view that there should be an allowance made to political parties who'd not handed in their candidate lists on time, despite very clear deadlines? Some political parties managed, some failed to do so. Would you concur with the IEC that it is in the best interests of democracy that parties like the ANC be allowed to do a late submission of candidate lists?
I sympathize with the Commission and therefore would support the Commission in that view. However, the law does not allow it. As far as I'm concerned and as far as I've read the Constitutional Court order, it does not allow the Commission to do so. So even if my personal feelings would have been that I sympathize with my former colleagues in terms of their interpretation of the Constitutional Court order, I think that this time around, they probably misinterpreted that order, because that order has limited its powers in terms of that it could exercise in terms of Section 11 of the Municipal Electoral Act, which basically says that the Commission may amend the election timetable in the interest of free and fair elections. In this case, The Constitutional Court qualified there by saying that notwithstanding the fact that the Commission has have those powers, it must stick to the election timetable, which was issued on the 4th of August.
Is the IEC, though, fulfilling its mandate if it does not allow the ANC to participate in these elections to the extent that it should? You know, it's not the ANC voters' fault that the party was incapable of fielding candidates on time. And, you know, if we're talking about free and fair elections and that is the primary purpose of the IEC, surely it's got to find a way to ensure that South African voters, for better or for worse, can exercise their vote in a way that they see fit?
Absolutely, there is no doubt about that. I mean, the IEC has obviously got to ensure that it applies the law in such a manner that it does not disadvantage any political party. But the law is the law. I mean, if the law says there's a cutoff date by a period by which a political party must comply, it must comply, and it does not really matter. And I always try to run away from having to deal with the specific of a political party. I just want to stick to the administration of law and what the law says as a person who is an administrator in the elections. And because immediately you bring in a political party, you then have got to differentiate between different political parties and the applicability of the law in relation to those parties. If the new Freedom Party was denied the right to participate in 2016 because it had missed the cutoff date, so any other political party that actually does miss that cutoff date would mean that it would not be allowed in terms of the same electoral scheme.
It's a sobering and concerning view, Terry Tselane, because, I mean, democracy has been hard fought for and hard won and is going to be held on to very vigorously by those who have got the privilege of political power. So I'm fascinated to see how this is going to play out because it is going to the courts and we'll see. You are born in Rustenburg. You grew up in Rustenburg. What was family life like in the Tselane household when Terry was a boy?
Well, I was brought up by my grandparents, and we were a very big family, as you'd imagine. If you are brought up by the grandparents, it would mean that you live with your uncles and your aunts and the children in the same household. But the beauty about that arrangement was that our grandparents were subsistence farmers, and then therefore most of the things that we needed were found in the fields.
So were you put to work as a young kid? Did you have to go and scuffle and do all the work of farm labor as a child?
Yeah, I did all those. I worked in the fields, I plowed the fields, and then I was also a head boy. I look after the cattle, and it was absolutely a wonderful experience for me to be doing all those things. Even though at the time when this was happening as a youngster, I didn't really appreciate it, but as time went on, I realized that I've learned so much from those kind of experiences.
What did you learn?
You know, independence, integrity, the importance of having to make sure that you put in place mechanism to fend for a family, whatever mechanism that you put in place to deal with those kind of issues, because my grandparents used the fact that they were subsistence farmers to basically cater for the family. All of us were educated and brought up by the products that were coming from the fact that they were subsistence farmers.
When did you leave Rustenburg? At what age did you go and spread your wings?
Well, I left Rustenburg basically when I was doing what we refer to as Form 1. By that time, my parents were now moving to Brits. There are so many things that I had learned by that time, because as a head boy, also we used to get wild berries or indigenous berries, and then, you know, I would sell those. So by the time I left Form 1, going to another school in Bethania in Brits, there are so many things that I had learned about basically managing my own resources. And after matriculating from Bethania, I went to the University of Botswana, where unfortunately I spent only 2 years. When I was doing my third year, I was expelled in terms of internal security, and I went to Wits University.
So Bob kicked you out and you went to Wits. And I mean, Wits was a hotbed of excitement at that sort of time as well. But you graduated. And you've done lots of really interesting jobs. I mean, you've always been interested in politics, but you've always also been interested in business. And at one point, you actually ran SA Tourism. I'd forgotten about that for a while. You were there for a 4 year, was it a 4 or 5 year term?
Yes, I was the chief executive of the Gauteng Tourism Authority for about 6 years. And then after that, I moved on to establish the Gauteng Film Commission as its chief executive. And only left after also 6 years to become now a full-time commissioner for the Electoral Commission.
I mean, were these not, you know, particularly high-paying jobs? They're very respectable and good jobs. And, you know, it's not, you're not creating enormous wealth along the way. Is wealth important to you?
Wealth is very, very important because through wealth, you can then be able to create value in the process, and then also be able to get new businesses and new areas of innovation. And I think the fact that I was part of these institutions helped me to help many people to develop. There were quite a number of small businesses that I developed in Gauteng Tourism Authority. Most of them, I still interact with them today. And then also in Gauteng Film Commission, there are quite a number of producers and quite a number of few businesses that I developed. And I'm proud to have made a contribution to the development of those businesses.
I mean, did the movie Bug Bite, did the tourism bug bite, has it led to any kinds of sort of money spending habits that we should be aware of? So many people get into a job and just realize they love traveling. Oh my goodness me, they love traveling. They get spoiled by all this corporate travel and they go and see the world and then they can't stop. And it ends up costing a fortune because also they can't go alone. So they take their partners with them and they just have to experience the world. Have you sort of fallen into that? It's a wonderful trap, but a trap nevertheless.
No. In fact, I learned that, very early on in my life when I left the university and I became the national organizer of the NECC, National Education Coordinating Committee. I was traveling throughout the country, establishing structures of, for the NECC for future education systems. And in so doing, I was basically not spending my money. I was being hosted in hotels. I was obviously because of the work that I was doing, not really spending the money that I was earning. And I made sure that I saved basically every cent of it. By the time I left the organization 3 years, I had saved almost every cent that I had actually worked for, which was absolutely wonderful because that's the first period when I actually learned that I can actually save so much money. I did not need to use that money. So even when I was with Gauteng Film Commission and Gauteng Tourism traveling, I always was conscious of the fact that I've got to save whatever little resources. If government or the organizations I was working for was paying for accommodation, there was no need for me to be spending money recklessly. I had to make sure that I still continue to save money for those moments when I would need to utilize those resources for other things.
And what have you invested in? I mean, have you been a good investor? Have you invested in other businesses? Have you invested in unit trusts? Have you bought retirement products? I wonder. I'm curious.
Yeah, well, when I started, obviously, basic things like unit trusts and education policies, retirement funds, you know, I invested in those areas. And I know that, Bruce, the majority of people that you interview here, they will talk about how they came from, you know, the rags to riches. I'm not that kind of a person. Even though I had been saving the resources, the fact that you're starting a new business, especially under COVID, would put strain on even the resources that you had saved. You would have to spend all the money that you have saved to basically develop a new business. But yes, at the period, at the time when I started, I indeed saved lots of resources in those different vehicles with understanding that at a later stage, I would need to use those resources for whatever purpose. And then IMSA, as an organization, provided me with an opportunity to spend those resources. But unfortunately, because of the COVID, as I've indicated, it put a lot of strain on the resources that one had saved over the years.
So you've had to draw down on some of your investments and some of your savings over time. But things are settling down a little bit now, though. I mean, I suppose as vaccinations take hold and as economies open up, things hopefully do become just a little bit more fluid and a bit easier.
Absolutely. We are all looking forward to that. I'm sure, I'm certain that any a person who is currently running a small business will tell you about the negative effect that the lockdown and COVID has had in their businesses. And therefore, all of us are really looking forward to a normalization of the situation so that we can begin to take advantage of opportunities that are out there. For instance, an organization such as ours, with an ambition of having to develop systems and clientele throughout the continent, was limited by the fact that we were not allowed to travel internationally. We could not leave our country. We were confined, you know, to our homes. And therefore, that has also had some kind of an impact on the capacity of the organization to develop as a fully fledged organization.
And people forget how bloomin' expensive it is to set these things up. You know, just the costs that you would never assume would be costs in setting up a business are enormous, and they are, you know, quite frightening. And if you don't have the cash flow, absolutely debilitating, ultimately.
Absolutely. I think, you know, quite a number of organizations that are not able to make it is largely because of those basic costs that one has got to incur to establish an organization. I mean, just a simple thing of having to establish a space from which you operate requires enormous investment. Whether you are going to be renting a property or you're going to be using your own home, you've got to invest a lot of resources. You've got to convert your home into a proper office. You've got to buy stuff that would make sure that you are able to operate. But you also need administrative capacity to be able to do so. You know, in the past, when I was part of a government institutions such as Gauteng Film Commission, Gauteng Tourism Authority, and the IEC, there was always, you know, a resource that one could actually rely on, whether it be, you know, human resources or otherwise. I didn't have to buy a computer, a laptop. I relied on the ones that have been bought for by the organization. I did not have to struggle about whether to employ an assistant or not. I didn't have to worry about having to now get an accountant or an auditor, because it was a given that the resources that are there, you would manage them in such a manner that you can be able to afford to have all the capacities that you require. But now when you are on your own, all of a sudden you realize that oh my goodness, now I need administrative support, because if I'm not available, there must be someone who can actually be able to do things. If I'm in hospital, someone must be able, the organization must still proceed and operate. And I've got to have someone now who's got a specialized skill. I need someone who, when my laptop, freezes, can be able to unblock it. I need to have now an IT specialist who can assist.
Terry, you're speaking the language of every startup. And it's the brutal reality of the real world. But listen, I mean, it's wonderful to hear you. And I'm sorry that things are a bit tough at the moment, but I'm sure that that you will overcome, as you have many times before. And the private sector is exciting, and the opportunities are enormous. And I wish you luck with the Institute of Election Management Services in Africa, IMSA. Terry Tselane, former commissioner of the Independent Electoral Commission.